The Wasteland, published in 1922. The Hollow Men, published in 1925. And then the central event, one could say, in Eliot's life, takes place in 1927, when this man who was raised Unitarian and had been searching for many years was baptized. Needless to say, being raised Unitarian and the Unitarians not believing in original sin, there was no need for baptism. They did not baptize. And Eliot requested to be baptized. But he was received into the Anglo-Catholic Church, not the Roman Catholic Church. There are a couple of reasons for this. I think maybe, and I won't rank these in importance. I couldn't tell you which is more important. But what you had was an American who had given up his American citizenship and become a British subject. And having done so, he felt a need to prove himself loyal to this new land he had adopted. And having left his American heritage behind and worrying that he had somehow betrayed his parents, his family, needless to say, were upset, disturbed, first by the marriage because they hadn't met the girl, and then by the fact he gave up his citizenship, became a citizen of a different country. It would have upset, and he was troubled by it. It would have upset everyone even more if then, having become a British subject, he had become a Roman Catholic. I think part of it was to prove himself a British subject. He had understood Catholicism, and the little passage I read earlier from 1917, talking about it being a coherent philosophy, a genuine philosophical system, he in his own mind made something of a compromise that this was for that moment as close as he could get, which, coming from Unitarianism, I would call an enormous movement forward. The second reason, though, had to do with something that had happened in Rome. I spoke earlier that he had become a devoted reader, follower of Charles Maurras, our Frenchman. I don't see him here, corrected my pronunciation. He told me that the S is pronounced at the end of the name. It's Maurras. And just at the moment when Eliot was going to be baptized and officially join a church, Pope Pius XI condemned Charles Maurras. It caused a scandal in intellectual circles that this man who had become a staunch defender of the church, the faith, Christian civilization, all of those things that Eliot had come to believe in, was condemned by the Pope in Rome. And there are some comments in some of the letters, offhand comments, where he talks about being disturbed at what the Pope had done to Maurras. So, the reasons I don't know for certain. But he was baptized at the age of, what would he have been? 39. At the age of 39, he was baptized by choice, by request. So that it was with full knowledge that he was becoming Christian, and then remained very devoted, went to that service every morning. But the one thing that is very interesting is that he apparently always carried with him a rosary and prayed the rosary on a regular basis. And in fact, in his office at Faber and Faber, he had a rosary that had been given him that was blessed by Pius XII. So I don't know. It's a mystery. I cannot tell you what went on. God knows. God will decide. It's not our call. But he then wrote nothing major in terms of poetry until 1930, when two poems came out. A long poem called Ash Wednesday, that I'll talk about in just a moment, but a short poem called Marina. I'm going to read this to you. It's quite fascinating. The title comes from a play of Shakespeare that no one knows, that Eliot called his favorite Shakespeare play. In fact, on a number of occasions, he referred to it as that very great Shakespeare play called Pericles. It's the first of the last four romances. And indeed, there's some controversy whether Shakespeare took an old play and just tampered with the first two acts and then wrote the last three acts. There are all sorts of textual problems. It was the one play that was left out of the first folio of 1623. Nobody knows why it was left out. It appeared in subsequent folios. There's no doubt it's Shakespeare's work. His fingerprints are all over it. It's an old story, and it was an old popular story, about a young man who is wooing the daughter of a king. It's a fairy tale story of a kind, and has to answer a riddle. It could take us back to the Chapel Perilous and the riddle that the knight has to answer. And he discovers the answer to the riddle is that the king is engaged in incest with his own daughter. So that if he answers correctly, he's going to be killed. He won't get the girl. And if he answers incorrectly, he doesn't get the girl. He's put himself in an impossible situation. He shouldn't be there at all. And he flees before he answers the riddle. And the king realizes this young man has caught on. We got to kill him. So he goes back to his own little kingdom, but then has to flee from there because he knows that the enemy is coming to get him. He goes off, he travels a bit, he meets a lovely young woman in another kingdom, there's a happy marriage, she's coming with him back to his kingdom, and she is pregnant at that point. There's a terrible storm at sea, the baby is delivered on the ship, the mother dies, is put in a coffin, thrown overboard because it's bad luck to have the corpse on the ship. He leaves the baby with a married couple he has met, another king and queen, because he doesn't know how he can raise it, and there's still the voyage back to his land, and loses touch. And then he is lied to and told the baby died. He believes his wife died at sea, and then his daughter died when she was young. The loss is almost too much for him, and he becomes a wanderer and a sullen, desperately unhappy man. What he does not know is that the coffin shows up at a shore of a distant island where there is a wise old man who brings the wife back to life. The daughter has survived, but she is sent off by the evil stepmother. And they attempt to have her killed to make the story true. But just as she's going to be killed, she's stolen by pirates and taken off. I'm not making any of this up. She goes off and she's told into a brothel. She's sold into a brothel where she refuses to do the job that women are supposed to do in a brothel and instead converts the men who come into the brothel and sends them off in shame. And then one day, he's now an old man, her father's ship comes to the shores of that town, and the poor old man is desperate, and someone says, well, this beautiful young girl should go see him because she heals everyone through her goodness and her beauty. And there is what Eliot called the single greatest reunion scene in all of literature, where slowly, the daughter realizes that's her father, and the father realizes his daughter did not die. This is his daughter before him. And then they learn the mother is still living. She has been a Vestal Virgin in the Temple of Diana, and the family is reunited. It's overwhelming. It's absolutely... Well, Eliot loved it. That very great play, Pericles. This poem is called Marina. It's named for the daughter. The epigraph comes from a play, a Euripides play about Hercules, where Hercules has gone mad, killed his own children, and then becomes sane and realizes what he's done. So it's the sense of suddenly waking up from madness and seeing the ruins around you, the guilt that I talked about last time that was in this man, of the wrongs he had done earlier in his life. But you'll notice there's a transition in the poem. Because of the virtue of hope. Here we go. What seas, what shores, what gray rocks and what islands, what water lapping the bow, and scent of pine and the wood thrush singing through the fog, what images return, O my daughter? Those who sharpen the tooth of the dog, meaning death. Those who glitter with the glory of the hummingbird, meaning death. Those who sit in the sty of contentment, meaning death. Those who suffer the ecstasy of the animals, meaning death, are become unsubstantial, reduced by a wind, a breath of pine, and the wood song fog, by this grace dissolved in place. What is this face, less clear and clearer, the pulse in the arm, less strong and stronger, given or lent, more distant than stars and nearer than the eye? Whispers and small laughter between leaves and hurrying feet under sleep where all the waters meet. Bowsprit cracked with ice and paint cracked with heat. I made this. I have forgotten and remember. The rigging weak and the canvas rotten between one June and another September. Made this unknowing, half-conscious, unknown, my own. The garboard strake leaks, the seams need caulking. This form, this face, this life living to live in a world of time beyond me. Let me resign my life for this life, my speech for that unspoken, the awakened, lips parted, the hope, the new ships. What seas, what shores, what granite islands towards my timbers, and wood thrush calling through the fog, my daughter. It's a beautiful poem. But notice in it is that old vision of death in the modern world that is somehow transformed by a miracle that seems almost incomprehensible. How could this possibly happen? And the old man in that old ship that he built that's coming apart and leaking, and how, but it doesn't matter because his life will be extended and there's the possibility of something outside of time, something higher, and there will be new ships. And the fact that his daughter has been restored to him gives him that great hope. It's a beautiful poem, beautiful poem. The same year, he published a longer poem called Ash Wednesday. It's in six parts. It is, if you will, the story of the process by which he finally fought his way free from the despair he was in and was given enough grace, was given a vision of something beautiful that pulled him towards a new life, a new hope that culminated in his baptism. But what is remarkable here, I'm just going to read a little bits of it, bits and pieces of it, is the honesty of the beginning. We begin with that sense of, it's hopeless, what can I do? There's no chance, it's too late for me. That's really part one of the poem. But then hope begins to be recovered, and it's recovered through two ladies. It's the women who somehow give him the hope. Now, the one is clearly identified as the virgin, who is mentioned throughout the poem. There is another woman in white. We don't know who she is, but she is devoted to the virgin. And as a result of her devotion, inspires the poet, inspires Eliot. He's using his own voice here. He speaks of himself, the I. It was a movement towards the we in the Hollow Men, and now the poem begins with the I. He has found his own voice finally. He can speak with his own voice without worrying that he's going to be mimicking some other poet. His voice is his own now. I'm just a little bit of part one. Because I do not hope to turn again, because I do not hope, because I do not hope to turn, desiring this man's gift and that man's scope, I no longer strive toward such things. Why should the aged eagle stretch its wings? Why should I mourn the vanished power of the usual rain? Because I do not hope to know again the infirm glory of the positive hour, because I do not think, because I know I shall not know the one veritable transitory power, because I cannot drink there where trees flower and springs flow, for there is nothing again. Because I know that time is always time and place is always and only place, and what is actual only for one time and only for one place. I rejoice that things are as they are, and I renounce the blessed face and renounce the voice, because I cannot hope to turn again. Consequently, I rejoice having to construct something upon which to rejoice and pray to God to have mercy upon us. And I pray that I may forget these matters that with myself I too much discuss, too much explain, because I do not hope to turn again. Let these words answer for what is done, not to be done again. May the judgment not be too heavy upon us. Because these wings are no longer wings to fly, but merely vans to beat the air which is now thoroughly small and dry, smaller and drier than the will. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Pray for us now and at the hour of our death. It's the man who wrote The Wasteland. Struggling. But notice what finally he can grab onto at the end. The Hail Mary. And the prayer is not broken there. The full line can come out. Part two begins, I'll just give you a touch of this. Lady, three white leopards sat under a juniper tree in the cool of the day, having fed to satiety on my legs, my heart, my liver, and that which had been contained in the hollow round of my skull. And God said, shall these bones live? Shall these bones live? And that which had been contained in the bones, which were already dry, said chirping, because of the goodness of this lady, and because of her loveliness, and because she honors the Virgin in meditation, we shine in brightness. And the dead bones can indeed start shining again. And it's because of this lady who's devoted to the Virgin. One of my favorite Eliot stories, it was after he had published this poem and was lecturing in some American university, a very bright student during the question period stood up and said, Mr. Eliot, when you said at the beginning of part two of your poem Ash Wednesday, lady, three white leopards sat under a juniper tree, what did you mean? And Eliot looked and said, I meant, lady, three white leopards sat under a juniper tree. People cannot imagine that poets put down words that mean what words mean. Now, there are any possibilities in terms of why he put it down there, any number of possibilities of how we respond to it, but he wouldn't presume to tell you what it meant, and that's how you have to take it. Okay, it's simply now. Of course, it's the old song from the Black South. Dem bones, dry bones, dem bones. And I wonder if he knew that song before he even knew the passage. It's Ezekiel, I think. Am I correct? Yeah, from Ezekiel about the dry bones. But the bones not only are alive again; they're shining with brightness. Okay. And then we get the poem turns into a brief litany. Lady of silences, calm and distress, torn and most whole, rose of memory, rose of forgetfulness, exhausted and life-giving, worried, reposeful, the single rose is now the garden where all loves end. Terminate torment of love unsatisfied, the greater torment of love satisfied, end of the endless, journey to no end, conclusion of all that is inconclusible, speech without word and word of no speech, grace to the mother for the garden, where all love ends. Under a juniper tree the bones sang, scattered and shining. We are glad to be scattered. We did little good to each other. Under a tree in the cool of the day, with the blessing of sand, forgetting themselves in each other, united in the quiet of the desert. This is the land which ye shall divide by lot, and neither division nor unity matters. This is the land. We have our inheritance. This is where you were put. Notice the sand is still there. It's still the desert. But this is our lot. This is our inheritance. This is what we have to deal with. And it's part of a higher plan. So deep breath. Let's go on and deal with it. It's quite remarkable. They're just lovely little things. This is part four. They're all very short. But the title of the poem, of course, Ash Wednesday. It's about a time of penance beginning, a time of sacrifice and penance beginning, that one has to go through in hope of that glorious end. But that's coming later. First, there is this long period. This is Ash Wednesday. So that when he finally comes to belief, he realizes this isn't a quick, easy, you know, problem solved. You know. This isn't Protestant Jesus, 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 I'm saved. This is with a full sense of his past, the enormity of what he has to make up for, and the fact that who knows where it will lead, but this is where I am and I go forward. Part four, who walked between the violet and the violet, who walked between the various ranks of varied green, going in white and blue, in Mary's color, talking of trivial things in ignorance and in knowledge of eternal dolor, who moved among the others as they walked, who then made strong the fountains and made fresh the springs, made cool the dry rock and made firm the sand, in blue of larkspur, blue of Mary's color, Sauvaigne Vos. Here are the years that walk between, bearing away the fiddles and the flutes, restoring one who moves in the time between sleep and waking, wearing white light folded, sheathed about her, folded. The new years walk, restoring through a bright cloud of tears the years, restoring with a new verse the ancient rhyme, redeem the time. Redeem the unread vision in the higher dream, while jeweled unicorns draw by the gilded hearse. The silent sister veiled in white and blue, between the yews, behind the garden god, whose flute is breathless, bent her head and signed but spoke no word. But the fountain sprang up and the bird sang down, redeem the time. Redeem the dream, the token of the word unheard, unspoken, till the wind shake a thousand whispers from the yew, and after this, our exile. I'm going to read part six, something very interesting here. Just remind you of a comment I read last night where he talked about the realization of the failure of the Unitarianism he'd been given as a boy to deal with the large issues, birth, copulation, death, heaven, hell, all of those big issues. Just keep that in mind. Although I do not hope to turn again, although I do not hope to turn, wavering between the profit and the loss, in this brief transit where the dreams cross, the dream cross twilight between birth and dying, bless me, Father, though I do not wish to wish these things from the wide window towards the granite shore, the white sails still fly seaward, seaward flying, unbroken wings. And the lost heart stiffens and rejoices in the lost lilac and the lost sea voices, and the weak spirit quickens to rebel for the bent goldenrod and the lost sea smell, quickens to recover the cry of quail and the whirling plover, and the blind eye creates the empty forms between the ivory gates, and smell renews the salt savor of the sandy earth. This is the time of tension between dying and birth, the place of solitude where three dreams cross, between blue rocks. But when the voices shaken from the yew tree drift away, let the other yew be shaken and reply. Blessed sister, holy mother, spirit of the fountain, spirit of the garden, suffer us not to mock ourselves with falsehood. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still, even among these rocks, our peace in his will, and even among these rocks, sister, mother, and spirit of the river, spirit of the sea, suffer me not to be separated, and let my cry come unto thee. It's beautiful. Beautiful. By the way, buried in there, our peace is in his will, comes from the third canto of Dante's Paradiso. Dante the Pilgrim meets Piccarda Donati, and he says to her, because heaven is this great unfolding rose, and all of the blessed ones are seated on petals of the rose as they spread out from God, who is the center, and Mary, who is there with the Queen of Heaven. So Dante is on the outer circle, if you will, and says to Piccarda, who's out there, don't you wish you had a better seat? don't you kind of wish you were closer to the center of things? And she says, oh, no, no, no. I am where God intended for me to be, and that is where I am is all of the glory that I could possibly endure and contain. And I am quite content with that because in nostra sua voluntate e nostra pace, because in his will is our peace. So this is where he willed me to be. I'm very happy to be here. I couldn't expect any more. And Eliot at the end of Ash Wednesday, okay? Our peace in his will, in his will. It's a remarkable, but notice, you can still tell it's Eliot. The shaping of the lines, the images that recur over and over again, that have been in the earlier poems. He's working with the same material, but it's now being transformed in a very special way. It's a poem to get to know. It's a lovely love. There are mysteries in it, you know. I tell you what it means, but I'm not sure. So it means what it put down in it, what you will discover in it. It's lovely. Now, he was working at Faber and Faber, the publishing house, very good to young poets, as helpful as he could be because of what Ezra Pound had done for him. It was a sense of, even often if he didn't care for their verse, he didn't pretend that his understanding was the ultimate understanding or that others might not like reading what he didn't. He was very, very good. Very good. And spoke of liking the regularity of that life. He had a very regular life. Poor Vivian was eventually institutionalized. He had started living apart from her. She had become impossible. And her mental state was deteriorating. And her family fully supported that she needed to be in an institution. And in fact, Eliot's brother-in-law helped him go through the ordeal of seeing his poor wife finally committed to an institution where she lived the rest of her days. He honored the marriage. He honored the marriage. There was no question that he would do anything else. So he lived a solitary life, did his job, wrote some poems, and very oddly, suddenly, a first love returned to him, and that was the love of the stage, those music halls from when he was young, and his love of the theater, because he had always enjoyed the theater. I would go back, it's in the it's the comment that he made in the obituary for Marie Lloyd, where he says, the lower class man who went to the music hall and sang the song along with Marie Lloyd was engaged in that collaboration of the audience with the artist which is necessary in all art, and most obviously in dramatic art. Because there has to be that connection between the actor on the stage and the audience out front. You talk to anyone who's done stage work, and they will tell you the quality of any night's performance depends on the quality of the audience. There will be, you're doing the same show. You're saying the same lines. The same scenery is behind you. And one night you'll go out there, and as a friend of mine in the theater would say, flop around on the stage like a dead fish, while the audience just sat there silent or perhaps wishing they could be somewhere else. It's just, it's horrifying. And then the next night, all of a sudden, you feel the energy, the excitement coming across the footlights to the stage, and it's one of the most thrilling experiences on earth. I remember I was in high school and wrote a fan letter to an actor at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, who was very kind and said, "Well, come back next time you're here. Come back after the show, and I'm happy to meet you and talk with you." Well, for a high school boy who was stage struck, it was whoa, you know, better than meeting the president. So after I went back, and every time I went after that, I'd go back afterwards and just say hello and chat a bit. It was very pleasant. I went one Saturday matinee to see a performance of Shaw's The Doctor's Dilemma, which is one of the Shaw plays that is top-notch. Shaw hated doctors. It's the most merciless assault on doctors ever written. If you want to cheer yourself up and have a good laugh and see doctors completely pilloried, read Shaw's The Doctor's Dilemma. Anyway, it was a wonderful production, very funny. The audience just roaring with laughter. I went back to see this good actor who had become a friend, and another actor came running up the stairs from the stage saying, "Lock the doors, keep them here, don't let that audience leave, make them stay tonight." They hadn't been getting the response they wanted, and all of a sudden it was like theater heaven. Every line that should get a laugh was getting huge laughs. Lock the door, don't let them out, make them stay. But the other thing is this. Eliot had been a solitary man. I've spoken of that. He was isolated. He had trouble being social. And now suddenly in the theater, he found a way of joining a community and becoming part of it and expanding his range of verse writing beyond just the printed page. And as he insisted, poetry is meant to be heard. It is an art that comes to the ear. And the great plays that he adored had all been, most of them, from the Greeks through Shakespeare, his love of the later Elizabethan dramatists, who were very influential on him. He loved verse plays. He was a poet. The problem was, how does a poet at that time, 1930s, begin to write verse plays? Well, the first thing that happened was an invitation. There was a pageant being staged that was going about the Anglo-Catholic churches in London, and it was called The Rock and was in praise of the church, and someone was bold enough to ask Mr. Eliot if he would write some choruses that could be spoken as part of this pageant, really just a theatrical pageant. And he agreed. Everyone was shocked because it wasn't the sort of thing he'd ever done before. And he wrote a number of choruses from The Rock. He was proud enough that he had them published. They're available. They're worth reading. One of my favorite lines in all of Eliot comes from one of the choruses from The Rock, where he's talking about the age in which he lived then and says, "And the wind shall say, here were decent, godless men, their only legacy, the asphalt road and 1,000 lost golf balls." Stern indictment. I was saying earlier, the problem is those decent, godless men of the 1930s are now godless and totally indecent. There has been this terrible decline since that point. I was reminded of the golf ball joke, and it really is a kind of joke, when, I don't know if you remember this, it was the second or third time that Americans went to the moon. And the first time they went, it was, you know, everybody watched, and man walked on the moon, and, well, I guess that's exciting, although there's virtually no art celebrating it. It's just sort of, oh, well, that happened. Then they went back, and it was, well, okay, I guess we went back. I think it may have been the third day they went back. And the question was, well, we get there, what do? We've collected the rocks, we've taken the rocks back. I don't know what. Do you know what they did? Maybe somebody remembers. They played golf. They took a golf club and a golf ball and knocked it around because there's very little gravity and you could see the golf ball go flying. There's excitement for you. There's what modern man through his science has accomplished. It's just, you know. There's only one lost golf ball on the moon, though, I think. Not a thousand. In any case, he wrote the choruses for The Rock. They were very successful. He got a little taste of the theater, which he'd always loved, and he'd now come to enjoy. So that was in 1934, and then the following year, almost immediately, a proposal came from Canterbury that he write a play that could be performed at Canterbury as part of a festival. And again, he said yes, and began working on his first full play that is an absolute masterpiece called Murder in the Cathedral, the story of the killing, the martyrdom of St. Thomas a Becket. It's an extraordinary play. It is, I don't know quite how to describe it other than to say, when it came out, it was unlike any other play that had been written. There were attempts by other poets to do verse plays. They were not terribly successful, and they've all vanished. Murder in the Cathedral is still done regularly. It is an extraordinarily powerful play. I've seen it, been lucky enough to see it three times. I went in 1988. I was lucky enough to go to the Eliot Centenary Celebration that was held at Washington University in St. Louis, the school founded by his grandfather. And they did a production of Murder in the Cathedral, there at Washington University. And it began, and when Thomas returned from France, which is the high point of the first act, Thomas returned in a golf cart. I thought, one, they have no taste, two, the director's an idiot, and three, they've obviously not read choruses from The Rock. Fortunately, they didn't have him bring golf clubs in. I exited the building at once, but I was fortunate to see it done once at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada. A superb performance, just stunning. What Eliot decided to do, there is a play written shortly after it by French playwright Jean Anouilh called Becket. It was turned into it was a successful stage play, Paris, London, New York, turned into what's a very good movie starring Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. What Anouilh does is tell the whole story, and you get the conflict between Becket, who becomes archbishop at the will of the king, and King Henry II. Burton plays Becket, O'Toole plays Henry II. And the conflict in the play is between those two. The conflict in Eliot's play, appropriately for this man and who he was and what he'd been, is an internal conflict in Becket himself. So that the play begins at the moment of his return from France. He has had to flee because the king gave him this position because they were good buddies, and it was expected that therefore Becket would do whatever the king wanted. Okay? Having become the archbishop, Becket begins defending the church against the state. And there is such upheaval in the land that finally Becket flees, goes to the Pope, and then stays in France on his return because he is worried about returning to England. It's very dangerous. But the moment has come when he will return. The rest of the play is quite simple. He returns. He knows what Henry must do at that point. its king or archbishop. And he expects that what will happen is there will be a last attempt to win him over to the king's side. That is, you become the servant of the state. Or he will be killed. And indeed, the first act, a series of tempters come to tempt him. I'll go through that in a moment. So the first act is really his return and the tempters. But one of the glories of the play, and especially since it is in a historical setting, it allowed Eliot to have a chorus, the way the old Greek plays did. And the chorus is the women of Canterbury, who love their archbishop, who have been waiting for his return, and now are terrified when word comes he may actually be returning, and don't want him there, because they know what will happen will upset their day-to-day life. And what the women of Canterbury give voice to is, we don't want anything to change. We lead our life, it's a tough life, but we have our lives, and we go from day to day, and that's sufficient for us, and we don't want anything to happen, so please just go away, because we want to pretend everything is fine. There's no agreement with Rome. Oh, no, that's something else. Excuse me. That's something else again. Just going to read the very opening of the first chorus. The play begins with the women of Canterbury, who indeed are there right at the cathedral in Canterbury, not far from here. We should have taken a little trip over there as well. Here let us stand close by the cathedral. Here let us wait. Are we drawn by danger? Is it the knowledge of safety that draws our feet towards the cathedral? What danger can be for us, the poor women of Canterbury? What tribulation with which we are not already familiar? There is no danger for us, and there is no safety in the cathedral. Some presage of an act which our eyes are compelled to witness has forced our feet towards the cathedral. We are forced to bear witness. Since golden October declined into somber November, and the apples were gathered and stored, and the land became brown, sharp points of death in a waste of water and mud, the new year waits, breathes, waits, whispers in darkness. While the laborer kicks off a muddy boot and stretches his hand to the fire, the new year waits, destiny waits for the coming, who has stretched out his hand to the fire and remembered the saints at All Hallows, remembered the martyrs and saints who wait. And who shall stretch out his hand to the fire and deny his master? Who shall be warmed by the fire and deny his master? I want to point out something to you. A word rings through that. Wait, wait, let us wait. The new year waits, waits, okay? Destiny waits for the coming. I find it very curious that two of the greatest plays, by, to my mind, the two greatest dramatists of the 20th century, are obsessed with waiting. One dramatist who has faith, the other dramatist who has no faith, Mr. Eliot. This whole play is about waiting for the martyrdom to take place. The other play is waiting for Godot, Samuel Beckett, who believed nothing. The world was empty. The two tramps on the roadway with the dry, withered tree right out of Eliot, who simply passed the time waiting for Mr. Godot to come, and at the end of Act One, a little boy comes in and says, Mr. Godot can't come today, but he'll come tomorrow. Act Two, two tramps waiting. They pass the time, they talk back and forth, the little boy comes, Mr. Godot can't come today, will he come tomorrow? Yes, he'll come tomorrow, end of play. There could be a third act, a fourth act, a fifth act. It's only the waiting. And people would say, well, Godot means God. And Becca would say, Godot means death. Or just wait for that. Blah, 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 blah. No, it's about the waiting. The other curious thing is this. Beckett, the non-believer, like Eliot, who became the believer, adored Dante. They were both immersed in Dante. There is a heartbreaking moment in Beckett's Waiting for Godot where the two tramps are talking and one of them says, do you remember the Gospels? And the other tramp says, I remember the maps in the back. The color of the sea was so blue. It's this sense that there was something there remarkable and beautiful, lost and gone. Lost and gone. Waiting, waiting, waiting. Great dramatist, great. Beckett wasn't a poet, he was a prose writer, but he had that artistic instinct. What are they telling us? We're waiting, we're waiting, we're waiting. What are we waiting for? What is this impulse? Eliot in the 30s, Beckett writing the play in the early 50s, waiting, waiting. I think we know. I think we know. The difference is, for Eliot, there was something to wait for that would be a transforming event. Now, the women. For us, the poor, there is no action but only to wait and to witness, okay? Then the priests come and try to send them away, saying, look, the archbishop may be coming. Don't stand around here all the time. And then the women begin to realize as the time approaches, we do not wish anything to happen. 7 years we have lived quietly, succeeded in avoiding notice, living and partly living. There have been oppression and luxury. There have been poverty and license. There has been some minor injustice. Yeah, we have gone on living, living, and partly living. Sometimes the corn has failed us. Sometimes the harvest is good. 1 year is a year of rain, another year of dryness. 1 year the apples are abundant, another year the plums are lacking. Yet we have gone on living, living, and partly living. It goes on and on. Okay? Let us just live. Don't upset it all. The second priest tries to drive the women away, and as he's doing it, Thomas enters. He returns, not in a golf cart, hopefully. Here we are. Listen, this is a tough, tough passage. Listen closely. Peace, and let them be in their exaltation. Their exaltation is just giving voice to what they're feeling and being articulate and being able to explain it. They speak better than they know and beyond your understanding. They know and do not know what it is to act or suffer. They know and do not know that action is suffering and suffering is action. Neither does the agent suffer nor the patient act, but both are fixed in an eternal action, an eternal patience, to which all must consent that it may be willed, and which all must suffer that they may will it, that the pattern may persist, for the pattern is the action and the suffering, that the wheel may turn and still be forever still. The pattern is designed by God. The individual souls play a part in that. But there can be an equal amount of action in the world simply by suffering the pain of living, submitting to God's will. Or there may be those who are called on to act in a very specific way, but even in acting they will undergo pain and they too will suffer. The whole pattern is based on suffering. And one reason that Thomas has returned is he knows it is his time now to suffer. He will not do anything. And then the tempters start arriving. The first temptation. Now, this is a historical play, but every historical play ever written by a major playwright poet is about the present time in which he writes. So this may be a retelling of the story of Thomas in Canterbury, but it is about things happening that Eliot is thinking of in the world he lives in. And the first tempter comes and says to Thomas, remember those fun days with the king when you were young? The feasts, the wine, the women, hey, Why don't you go back to that? The first temptation, and in a way the temptation of youth, sensuality, which pretends to give a false joy, Becket rejects it out of hand. He is now of an age, is possessed of a kind of wisdom where he rejects it out of hand. The second tempter comes and says, make your peace with the king. He'll take you back in a minute, your old friends. You can have your nice little cathedral here. You'll get along. Make the compromise with the state. Because once you make the compromise with the state, problems cease, life is good. You've got your nice little church. Open yourself up to the world. Let the world be at one with you, but you have to make the step because, you know, you've cut yourself off from that world. Eliot's writing about Vatican II before it happened. And it's the second temptation. Hey, make your peace. Just get along, okay? He says in one of his essays that it's a good sign when there is contention between the church and the state. And if the church is too cozy with the state, it means there's real trouble in the church. Then the third tempter comes. And the third tempter says, join the barons who want to overthrow the king. What's the third modern temptation? What we talked about in the Hollow Men, rebellion, revolution, change, progress. Let's overthrow the old order. Join with us. We are the future. We've got the slogans. We've got the power. We can bring the king down. We'll take control. You'll be our leader. There'll be hope. There'll be change. There'll be a new life. There'll be a new springtime. Every one of the sensuality is a constant temptation. The tension between church and state is an ongoing temptation. The rebellion is a real mark of the modern age. Come on, let's go out and rip it all down. That'll be good. Then we'll be in power and we can do what we want. And he rejects the third tempter. And at that point, he thinks he's overcome them all when a fourth tempter shows up. And Thomas is shocked, and indeed says, I didn't expect you. I didn't expect this to happen. And the fourth tempter presents him with a temptation he had not expected, which is, Thomas, be a martyr. Whoa, be a martyr. And then you'll be a saint, and you'll be remembered always, and your name will be famous, and you'll spill a little blood, but it's well worth it because you'll have publicity for all the rest of your days. And what one really wants is celebrity. You be a martyr now, and you can be a real celebrity. You'll be a media star. And he's taken aback by it because it was totally unexpected. No, who are you tempting with my own desires? Others have come, temporal tempters, with pleasure and power at palpable price. What do you offer? What do you ask? I offer what you desire. I ask what you have to give. Is it too much for such a vision of eternal grandeur? It's magnificent. It's a great scene. And Thomas is forced to look inward and say, is there no way in my soul's sickness does not lead to damnation in pride? I well know that these temptations mean present vanity and future torment. Can sinful pride be driven out only by more sinful? Can I neither act nor suffer without perdition? And the tempter says, you know and do not know what it is to act or suffer. You know and do not know that action is suffering and quotes his own words right back to him. right back to him. Pride, pomposity, and suddenly he's hit with the very thing he said earlier. And at that point, the shock is enough, and he overcomes the fourth temptation. And the first act ends. Now is my way clear, he says. Now is the meaning plain. Temptation shall not come in this kind again. The last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. Wonderful lines. Wonderful lines. Because it means one is filled with pride, which is the very first of the sins. I know what yet remains to show you of my history will seem to most of you at best futility, senseless slaughter of a lunatic, arrogant passion of a fanatic. I know that history at all times draws the strangest consequence from remotest cause. But for every evil, every sacrilege, crime, wrong, oppression, and the axe's edge, indifference, exploitation, you and you and you must all be punished. So must you. I shall no longer act or suffer to the sword's end. Now my good angel, whom God appoints to be my guardian, hover over the sword's points. Let the swords come when they will. Let God decide what my future is. I just go about my business. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. There's an interlude which is a sermon, a Christmas Day sermon. As you well know, he was killed shortly after Christmas. Now becomes one of those during the octave of Christmas. It's one of those days of celebration. So Eliot writes a Christmas sermon. It's in prose. It's a great sermon. I'll make you read it yourselves. I'm not going to go through it because look at me. I've talked too long again. I need to wrap this up. Part two. The king sends the knights to kill Thomas. And the poor chorus of women are even more disturbed because they sense it is coming. And the knights burst into the cathedral. They want to know where he is. And indeed echo the same words as the chorus of women did. How much longer will you keep us waiting? Waiting, 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 okay? They accuse him of all sorts of things. The chorus realizes what's about to happen. I can't read all this. It is so stunning. Some call it some of the greatest poetry Eliot had written up to this point. I have smelt them, the death bringers. Senses are quickened by subtle forebodings. I have heard fluting in the nighttime, fluting in owls. Have seen at noon scaly wings slanting over, huge and ridiculous. I have tasted the savor of putrid flesh in the spoon. I have felt the heaving of earth at nightfall, restless, absurd. I have heard laughter in the noises of beasts that make strange noises. Jackal, jackoss, jackass, jackdaw, the scurrying noise of mouse and gerbos, and laugh of the loon, the lunatic bird. I have seen gray necks twisting, rat tails twining in the thick light of dawn. I have eaten smooth creatures still living with the strong salt taste of living things under the sea. I have tasted the living lobster, the crab, the oyster, the whelk, and the prawn, and they live and spawn in my bowels, and my bowels dissolve in the light of dawn. I have smelt death in the rose, death in the hollyhock, sweet pea, hyacinth, primrose, and cowslip. I have seen trunk and horn, tusk and hoof in odd places. Just the women are frantic because death is in the air. And being women, they have felt it coming. They have known in their hearts something terrible is coming. He quiets them. It's beautiful. Peace, and be at peace with your thoughts and visions. These things had to come to you and you to accept them. This is your share of the eternal burden, the perpetual glory. This is one moment, but know that another shall pierce you with a sudden painful joy when the figure of God's purpose is made complete. There's an action, and it will have an end. It's not a Beckett, over and over, repetition, endless, where there is no end point. And indeed, he prepares to go say Mass, and the knights come. And when they come, this is an amazing thing. They're ready. Their swords are drawn. And notice, listen to the music of the poetry. You should know where this sort of thing comes from. Where is Becket, the traitor to the king? Where is Becket, the meddling priest? Come down, Daniel, to the lion's den. Come down, Daniel, for the mark of the beast. Are you washed in the blood of the lamb? Are you marked with the mark of the beast? Come down, Daniel, to the lion's den. Come down, Daniel, and join in the feast. Where is Becket, the Cheapside brat? Where is Becket, the faithless priest? Come down, Daniel, to the lion's den. Come down, Daniel, and join in the feast. It's the music hall. It's music hall rhythms. It's pop. Boom, 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 boom. It's rock music before its time. It's absolutely horrifying. And indeed, they slay him. They kill him. And the chorus of women are overcome. Again, I can't read the full chorus, but clear the air, clean the sky, wash the wind, take stone from stone and wash them. The land is foul, the water is foul, our beasts and ourselves defiled with blood. A rain of blood has blinded my eyes. Where is England? Where is Kent? Where is Canterbury? Oh, far, far, far in the past. And I wander in a land of barren boughs. If I break them, they bleed. I wander in a land of dry stones. If I touch them, they bleed. How can I ever return to the soft, quiet seasons? Night, stay with us. Stop, sun. Hold, season. Let the day not come. Let the spring not come. Can I look again at the day and its common things and see them all smeared with blood through a curtain of falling blood? You need a good chorus, obviously, but that's powerful stuff. And then suddenly the theater lights come on. And the four knights come out and talk in modern prose to chat with the audience. They introduce themselves, and indeed they're the historical characters who actually murdered Thomas. They identify themselves, and each one gives the reason why Thomas had to die. And they're convincing the audience, look, this really was a necessary act. And we're sure you'll agree with us. If you're good enough, listen to our arguments and we'll go through it with you, okay? It's a very scary moment because it's modern politics. All of a sudden, they're modern politicians explaining, no, there were weapons of destruction in Iraq. We had to go in there and just, turn the country into total chaos. That was absolutely necessary. And the cost of, all those lives, and it was well worth it. And, well, just listen to me. I'll explain to you why. It's modern politics. And as a result, the theater lights go on, and they're talking to the audience. You got to agree with this. This is what's going on. The fourth night, I'm starting halfway through his argument. From the moment he became archbishop, he completely reversed his policy. He showed himself to be utterly indifferent to the fate of the country, to be, in fact, a monster of egotism. This egotism grew upon him until it became at last an undoubted mania. I have unimpeachable evidence to the effect that before he left France, he clearly prophesied in the presence of numerous witnesses that he had not long to live and that he would be killed in England. He used every means of provocation. From his conduct step by step, there can be no inference except that he had determined upon a death by martyrdom. Even at the last, he could have given us reason. You have seen how he evaded our questions, and when he had deliberately exasperated us beyond human endurance, he could still have easily escaped. He could have kept himself from us long enough to allow our righteous anger to cool. That was just what he did not wish to happen. He insisted, while we were still inflamed with wrath, that the doors should be opened. Need I say more? I think with these facts before you, you will unhesitatingly render a verdict of suicide. While of unsound mind, it is the only charitable verdict you can give upon one who was, after all, a great man. Whew. the modern mentality. Totally twisted, absolutely crazy, self-justifying. Putting the fault out there. Again, it's all happening out there. Nothing wrong with me. The original title of the play that Elia wanted to use was called The Archbishop Murder Case. He was a big fan of detective stories. He could quote, apparently, whole pages of Sherlock Holmes stories. He loved Sherlock Holmes. And he read detective novels. So this, he was, in a way, hoping, you know, the Archbishop Murder Case, and then it solved at the end because the fourth night convinces us it was a suicide. Of course, that's not the end of the play by any means. It's utterly horrifying. But it's there, that kind of modern justification, where martyrdom is reduced to suicide. Self-interest, just self-interest, has no other meaning. I'll just read the final chorus. It's, again, the women of Canterbury are there throughout. Their poetry is extraordinary. There is a Te Deum being sung by a choir in the far distance. We praise thee, O God, for thy glory displayed in all the creatures of the earth, in the snow, in the rain, in the wind, in the storm, in all of thy creatures, both the hunters and the hunted. For all things exist only as seen by thee, only as known by thee. All things exist only in thy light, and thy glory is declared even in that which denies thee. The darkness declares the glory of light. Those who deny thee could not deny if thou didst not exist, and their denial is never complete, for if it were so, they would not exist. They affirm thee in living. All things affirm thee in living. The bird in the air, both the hawk and the finch. The beast on the earth, both the wolf and the lamb. The worm in the soil and the worm in the belly. Therefore man, whom thou hast made to be conscious of thee, must consciously praise thee in thought and in word and in deed. Even with the hand of the broom, the back bent in laying the fire, the knee bent in cleaning the hearth, we, the scrubbers and sweepers of Canterbury, the back bent under toil, the knee bent under sin, the hands to the face under fear, the head bent under grief, even in us the voices of seasons, the snuffle of winter, the song of spring, the drone of summer, the voices of beasts and of birds praise thee. We thank thee for thy mercies of blood, for thy redemption by blood, for the blood of thy martyrs and saints shall enrich the earth, shall create the holy places. For wherever a saint has dwelt, wherever a martyr has given his blood for the blood of Christ, there is holy ground, and the sanctity shall not depart from it, though armies trample over it, though sightseers come with guidebooks looking over it, from where the western seas gnaw at the coast of Iona, to the death in the desert, the prayer in forgotten places by the broken imperial column, from such ground springs that which forever renews the earth, though it is forever denied. Therefore, O God, we thank thee who hast given such blessing to Canterbury. Forgive us, O Lord. We acknowledge ourselves as type of the common man, of the men and women who shut the door and sit by the fire, who fear the blessing of God, the loneliness of the night of God, the surrender required, the deprivation inflicted, who fear the injustice of men less than the justice of God, who fear the hand at the window, the fire in the thatch, the fist in the tavern, the push into the canal, less than we fear the love of God. We acknowledge our trespass, our weakness, our fault. We acknowledge that the sin of the world is upon our heads, that the blood of the martyrs and the agony of the saints is upon our heads. Lord, have mercy upon us. Christ, have mercy upon us. Lord, have mercy upon us. Blessed Thomas, pray for us. Eliot made his pilgrimage to Canterbury. Yeah. Thank you.